Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean bringing you a show called Getting It Done. And I'm ready to get it done. This week we have a show that has already been recorded, and it's about structural racism and how it works, being conducted by Teresa Rose, actually PhD, director and professor of African-American studies and a research scientist on the field of what racism really is all about at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. That's who you're going to be listening to. Let's give it up and hear what she has to say. Sit back and enjoy.
My name is Teresa Rose, and I'm a Chancellor's Professor of Africana Studies here at Brown. I've been at Brown as a professor for 11 years, and I didn't put this year, I should say, class of 1993, which was not my undergraduate year, it was my graduate degree. I did my PhD here at Brown, I'm really, really excited to see you all here so I can share some of my research and what I've been up to for the last couple of years, but also because this research and a lot of the thinking behind it dovetails with my role at the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. I have both a banner and a description now, because our job and my interest in directing that center is to help bring to the public ideas about race and inequality and research about these issues. Immigration policy, racial discrimination, indigenous issues, to bring that kind of knowledge to the everyday public and create more informed conversations, because frankly, it appears that we're moving in the opposite direction in terms of complexity and deep knowledge about these issues, and it's extremely important for us to have a relatively peaceful and just society. In order to do so, we need to know these things. So, this project is really exciting to me. It's a tough project intellectually and materially, but it's also tough emotionally. So it's tough on a lot of fronts. So I hope you all brought your coffee. Did everyone bring, are you fully caffeinated, sort of mainlined before you got here? Okay. So this is going to be a two-part presentation. Normally I do all of the presenting when I do these things, but I have a key researcher, Sam Rose, in class of 2014, who also did a thesis with me on colorblindness and its relationship to structural racism, pretty much. And he's also, I'll give you his bio when I introduce him more fully, but he's really done a tremendous job over the last couple of years with me thinking through the project. So we're going to do two parts today. I'm going to lay out for the first, say, almost two-thirds, but a little bit less, maybe half, of our time, the big bones of the project. What are we doing? Why have we structured it the way we structured it? What are my main concerns? What are the issues at stake, sort of big picture? And then we're going to drill down to a very specific case study, which Sam is going to present. So the goal here is to say, here is this big picture. Well, how does it play out on the ground? How does it play out in a way that helps us understand actually how it's impacting everyday lives and our own perceptions? Okay? You with me? Okay, if I go too fast, which I am known to do because I am from New York and we do everything fast, because you have to, please holler. I tell students to just like frantically wave, and it works fine for, you know, families and parents and friends as well. So feel free to do that. Okay, I'm going to start with the definition, because of course you can't really talk about structural racism if you're not sure what you're talking about. So what is structural racism? Before we can figure out how it works. So this is my operative definition. They share many of these traits. And the basic definition is that structural racism in the United States is the normalization and legitimization of an array of dynamics, historical, cultural, institutional, and interpersonal, that routinely advantage whites while producing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes for people of color. Now, these words are long, and the definition may seem long, but it's important because they're key. If you look at just a couple of key words before we move along. Normalization. Normalization means that structural racism is built into the everyday practice. We're not talking about exceptional behavior, individual bad attitudes. We're not talking about the occasional negatively intentional policy. We're really talking about a process that happens in a normal, everyday way that goes on in as part of our air that we breathe, but that is often quite invisible to us, not all of us, but to some of us. But it's important that it can go on while we're sleeping, while we're fighting for justice, while we're doing whatever we're doing. Legitimization is important because we legitimize institutions, and I'm going to talk later about how this happens, that are actually functioning in structurally racist ways. The outcomes are clearly producing dramatic, cumulative, and chronic adverse outcomes, and they nonetheless have quite legitimacy. They have a lot of legitimacy. This is not something that is marginal, again, and on the side. The second piece of the definition that's really important is that structural racism is not just the past that has a legacy that's waning in the present. It has present formulation. So it's historical, yes, but it's also present tense. There are cultural elements to it. That means it has to do with the way we talk about race that helps produce it. It's not just policies, but it is institutions and policies. We see it in government policy. We see it in corporations and their policies. We see it in educational institutions. And, of course, it is also interpersonal. And by interpersonal, I don't just mean, sort of screaming people at the Walmart, which seems to be a new problem we're having in the United States. But it does mean that, right, because that's part of it. But it also means the ways in which we interact and the ways in which we create relationships with one another. So our project is really, it started as, as many things in my life academically have started, which is something that seems like I should be able to do it quickly and then takes like forever. So this is one of those, I can just explain structural racism to everyday people, do a multimedia project with a couple of videos, put them online on YouTube, pull up a website, do some research, bam, we'll be all set, 6 months. Okay, 2 years later, we're standing here in front of you, like, really still working it out for a lot of different reasons. But we feel more and more convinced about the importance of the project and the importance of these areas. So what's happened for us is that we're trying to focus on these five critical areas where structural racism is highly dynamic and consequential. There are others, so don't even worry about asking me that. There are definitely others than these five. These five really apply to all of us in here. Hopefully not criminal justice, but if not, then that may itself be part of the puzzle, right, if you've never had a brush with the law. But the others, for sure, housing, education, mass media, wealth, and jobs, are just critical fundamental anchors. The outcomes in these areas determine fundamentally the quality of life, the sense of safety and security, and the opportunity that our citizens in this country have. So I want to lay it out this way for a moment, because this is usually how we talk about it. We talk about wealth, we talk about housing, we talk about media, whether it's representation and images of people of color or African Americans, which is the group we're going to mainly focus on, whether it's educational outcomes or the criminal justice system. We tend to look at these things in isolation from one another. And this is not a bad idea when we want to drill down, because if you want to look at the significance of, say, racialized wealth inequality, which is dramatic, and I'll point that out in a moment, you want to figure out why and how, so you have to go down and into it, right? You have to keep moving in more deeply. But at the same time, it's extremely important to think about how these gears, as we're thinking of them, work together. And they are actually not operating in a single sphere way, that there are interlocking effects. And this is key to our argument. This is key to our approach, that we think about how various aspects of society produce structural inequalities in ways that are interdependent, interactive, and compounding. This is extremely important because, again, if we find a disparity in, say, job discrimination or unemployment, there's a tendency to say, well, if we just fix that, we're good, right? But if you look at the interlocking effects and you come to the realization that in any one sphere you have discrimination and inequality, past, present, and in policy and in thinking, and it's really driving inequality in other areas, you can't possibly think in a single sphere way to solve any given problem that we're dealing with. So we're making an argument that it's not just structural in the big picture sense in isolated ways, but it's interlocking and interdependent. So this whole talk could be statistics of data, and we're not going to do that. I'm going to give you just a symbol fill of it, but I'm going to assume that many of you have been paying attention to these issues. Otherwise, you wouldn't have roused yourself probably at 7:30 in the morning to come here to listen to me talk about it if it was completely unfamiliar to you. So just very quickly, black unemployment today is worse than it was in 1964, but more importantly, it hovers at twice the white unemployment rate pretty much all the time. And I want to draw your attention very quickly to the Great Recession, when unemployment rates for whites was around 9 or 10, sometimes 11%, and it was a national catastrophe, crisis. How can we survive 10 or 11%? Well, black unemployment hovers at 12 to 15% all the time. It was 19% during that recession. So if you want to figure out how to survive that crisis, we have people to talk to. School segregation has gotten worse since the early 1990s, and that segregation is driven really by housing segregation, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. But what's important too is that due to a variety of structural conditions, largely in housing and elsewhere, the more homogeneous a black school gets, and the less white it gets, the poorer it gets. So race is an indicator also of economic disadvantage as it plays out in schools and elsewhere. Now, criminal justice is a huge sphere. We could talk about many things, but there are a couple of key things. One is that for the past 30 years, we have quadrupled the number of people in prison, mostly from drug arrests. Number one, blacks are jailed at 6 times the rate of whites, despite the fact that whites use and sell drugs at a higher rate. I know you may find that hard to believe. If you follow mass media and news reports and the sense, you think that all African Americans do is sell, buy, and consume drugs in the United States. So if you actually think about the consequences of this, this would mean that we couldn't have, if we followed who's actually doing the drugs, we couldn't possibly have the disparity that we have. But we have a policing process that confirms and looks for and seeks out and finds the drugs that we're looking for in segregated neighborhoods. And then another key point is that we do not sentence blacks and whites for the same crimes equally. Blacks should receive longer sentences for the same crimes, and this is on top of the fact that whites are not likely to be charged with crimes in the first place. So that longer sentence plays out even more significantly. Wealth is a massively significant component of the process of structural racism. But just since the 1980s, the black-white wealth gap has quadrupled. And the gap at this point is roughly $11,000 in wealth for African Americans to $142,000 on average, the median wealth for white families. That is a staggering gap that no amount of hard work will breach. It just simply will not be closed with hard work. Key points to keep in mind about structural racism overall. One is that we do not have to be aware of it or any of these factors in order for the system to work. Two, it's fueled by and relies on racial ideas and stereotypes to perpetuate outcomes. And this is important because I'm going to show how the way we think about race and the stereotypes we activate and the unconscious bias we activate actually produces the outcomes in the material world. And whether, you know, and this is important because changing policy by itself won't change necessarily what's going on unless we tackle ideas. And they matter because they really hide structural racism right in front of us. And I'm going to give you an example. And the most important thing, though, is that we can know ourselves to be unracist in every bone in our body and still be functionally deeply advantaged by this system and participate in it all the time. This is a difficult thing to really confront because we've talked about ourselves as Americans as having transcended this kind of racial outcome and investment since the 1960s. That's been our main story. that we're now a meritocracy, that we've ended structural barriers, that we're post-race. I know right now this seems like a weird old school fantasy that we thought. I know. I didn't believe it when it was said. I saw this kind of thing coming. I was like, oh no, this isn't going to be pretty. But what did most people think? Oh my gosh, we've got one African American, you know, sort of. We have half an African American in the White House. How exciting, you know, and this month everything's gone. Structural racism, poof, magic. But discriminatory outcomes do not have to rely on racist or discriminatory intentions. So how is structural racism made invisible? The first is this obsession with the illusion of meritocracy. Now, let me first say that the fact that we do not have a meritocracy, in my opinion, does not mean that people don't deserve good jobs, that they haven't worked hard, that they're not smart. It means that the system is structured for some people's hard work to matter a lot more than other people's hard work, and therefore it's not a functional meritocracy. If because rewards, if the meritocracy is that rewards in society go naturally to those who are the best performers, and that positions or achievements of individuals depend on their abilities and effort, and does not depend on class, race, or other group advantages, then obviously we're not a functional meritocracy. We have lots of merit, we try, but we do functionally fail, and this is very important to confront, because it is the myth of this meritocracy that actually helps drive our misguided thinking about race in the first place. So inside the meritocracy myth is the belief that we ended racism with the civil rights movement. Lawrence Bobo, a political scientist at Harvard, has done lots of attitude studies, and one of them shows that over 60% of whites think that we've reached racial equality now. It'll be like right now. TikTok still, right now. And 20% say it's coming soon. So that's 80%. Well, it's a little higher. I actually brought it down to an even number. It's more like 83%. 16% of blacks think that we've reached racial equality, but 32% think we're going to get there, which just speaks to the hopefulness of people of African descent, because there's not a ton of evidence of us getting there soon. I told you you needed to have caffeine for this situation, right? I did warn you. I gave you a heads up. It's not pretty data. But this perception really matters, because if we believe that racism ended with the civil rights movement and we're mostly just cleaning up a few kind of leftover vestiges of these problems, then when we find deep disparity, right, it contributes to alternative explanations. We don't say, oh, yeah, structural racism, because it's not in our parlance, it's not our understanding. We come up with various types of, you know, mechanisms to compensate. One of my favorites is the anomalies. Well, yes, over here, but I know a guy who hired 5 African Americans. You know, I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. You know, are we going to solve this one man's job hiring program at a time? I don't think so. Or a one bad apple thesis. This comes up a lot with police, right? That, you know, one bad cop, some evil bad cop, as if he could function without a whole culture around him to enable it. So what remains? If it's the case, this is not the case, but this is a false proof I'm setting up, if no or few structural impediments exist, then why do we have such disparate outcomes? The answer becomes behavior, and this idea that individual behavior or collective black cultural practices produce disparate outcomes like this across all major aspects of society, this activates and relies on a deep well of stereotypes and bias. You guys following me? Am I going too fast? Excellent. You guys are perfect brown students. All right. So let me give you a quick example. Unemployment rates, labor force, Census Bureau, 2010. I told you before, it's often twice. Here's your evidence. 8.7% for non-Hispanic whites unemployment, 12.5% for Hispanics, 16% for blacks. It was 2010. That was a little bit higher than your average because it was 2010. If you recall, that was not a pretty time. But it's pretty much double, as I said, it always is. How do we explain it? If you're giving a structural analysis, explain this by looking at housing discrimination, which is, there are many, many studies, and if we were approaching this as my own 50-minute talk, I would go into some of these, but there's tremendous evidence for significant hiring discrimination, even at entry-level jobs. There's profoundly limited accessible opportunities based on distance, transportation, and housing, segregation and isolation, and social networks. Almost all jobs are social networks. I know a guy, which is a Rhode Island thing, but everybody uses it. I know a guy who can do that. Oh, yeah? Well, you trust me, so you trust the guy I say. So ask how, what percentage of white social networks constitute black people? If you're white, how many, what percentage of your social network is black? Shout it out like the kids. 5%. Anyone, maybe give me one more number. 30%. Very optimistic. Amen. That's the number. Do you do math? Because that came out as perfect. So you have what I call intuitive math, which is what I have. I don't have real math either. 1%. 1%. Okay? That's rather significant. But what do we hear all the time in the news? Now, a lot of these stereotypes apply not just to African Americans. We're just going to have to. Okay. All right. Not just to African Americans, but they specifically get reinforced around black people and black culture. They're lazy. They don't want to work hard. That lacks discipline, lacks proper values, prefer handouts. Paul Ryan's report on poverty made this argument consistent, you know, all over the place. It didn't say that there was any kind of discrimination, only behavior. So I want to move to the question of crime because it's important to understand how pivotal and what a linchpin the idea of African Americans as fundamentally criminal drives a variety of spaces and circumstances. A report by the Sentencing Project was specifically looking at perceptions of crime and the ways in which it produces not only criminal justice outcomes, but other kinds of outcomes. And I want to just draw your attention to the fact that I'm talking here about conscious stereotypes and unconscious bias. These are two different spaces, but they're both important. So there's things people say that they think to be true, and then there are things that we don't even know about. 80% of our brain is completely inaccessible to us. Well, I don't know what's going on down there in that basement, but it's pretty heavy. One of the things going on is a deep belief that black people are more criminal. And this starts really with the moment of emancipation. As soon as slavery ends, during slavery, black people are not criminal. But magically, as soon as they're free, they're pretty dangerous and problematic. Well, recent studies, though, show that whites overestimate the actual share of burglaries, illegal drug sales, and juvenile crime committed by African Americans by 20 to 30%. This pattern is confirmed in widespread implicit bias research. Media crime coverage reinforces this bias. There's many, many reports that show that the way black criminals are portrayed, the emphasis on crimes that are more likely to be done by blacks but not by others, produce a reinforced relationship between black people and crime in the psyche. It's reinforced by higher sales and status for movies, music, and arts that revolves around African-Americans' criminal behavior and character. My own work on hip-hop, I talk a lot about this, that artists that don't talk about being a gangster do not sell as well. And it's not just because those stories are more exciting, it's because they fulfill a conscious and unconscious sense of authenticity about what black people are really supposed to be. And it justifies draconian policing policies, and most important for what I want to do next, it drives housing and schooling decisions. So I don't have time to go into this at the depth that I wanted to, but this is, if you take the housing gear, you will see that there are lots of policies, past and present, that have had a deep impact on what we have always seen in the housing arena, which is significant segregation and significant economic disempowerment. And I would love to give you an hour-long lecture on all of these, but I want to just very quickly focus on, for the moment, the pivotal nature of a process called redlining. How many of you know what redlining is? Excellent. I don't need to spend a lot of time on it. So just for the sake of just a couple of key factors here. One, it was a government policy, New Deal, so Democratic, so don't get all grumpy if you're a Democrat trying to blame somebody else. Democratic policy meant to help communities be funded for housing, was racially specific, and was a corporate collaboration, because this was a homeowner's loan corporation founded by the government. Color-coded created a system. Why we call it redlining is that neighborhoods that were considered red and a red perimeter around them were neighborhoods where any black people lived, even only one, were marked in red, given the lowest rating on the system and rules completely ineligible for home or business loans. This goes on. I'm born well into, not too long before 77, but long enough to say that this is actually going on consistently across the country, uninterrupted, and this is just one piece of the puzzle, creating a number of factors that are extremely important. Not only is it starving Black communities of economic resources, it's elevating the whiter the community is. It's creating a financial incentive for white homogeneity. You following me? This is very important because it itself produces thinking about race. Because you're like, well, whiteness has value. Oh, that's right. Here's my white house, basically, in my white neighborhood, in my white school. It's more valuable. Of course it's more valuable. It's more important. It's more valuable. And you've got a reciprocal process. So let me just vary. This is the most important thing I want to have us think about today is this relationship. So redlining and other strategies that maintain segregation, they choked off the value of any investing in Black communities and suppressed the value of property. And in fact, gentrification as we know it today is impossible without the history of redlining and the destruction of value in poor communities that they themselves should have been able to access but can't, and now others find the prices to be so cheap because this process of has been going on. So it created Black ghettos by redlining and constraining and segregating neighborhoods and creating asset reduction in those communities. It reinforced associations of Blackness with poverty and struggle in community, artificially raises the value of white neighborhoods in a higher market value, which in turn fuels educational inequality and segregation. As we all know, we fund, for those of us who still send our kids to public schools, it's another racial and class effort to create segregation, but taxes fund our educational units, and therefore if you have higher property values for your house, you have more money for your schools, so there's an incentive to pass this on intergenerational wealth through education alone, not to mention passing on these homes to our children, which does what? Fund their college, weather financial crisis, weather health crises. You don't have excellent health coverage for some reason and your child is doing, you know, some entrepreneurship, right? You can cover their health. You can pay for it by second mortgages with that wealth gap that we talked about, $11,000 in assets to $142,000 on average. So it rationalizes, I'm moving down to this one, it rationalizes white protectionism. Protecting white neighborhoods is safer and profitable. It makes fear of Black people financially reasonable. It stigmatizes neighborhoods that are diverse, no matter how safe, friendly, or stable. It fuels white self-segregation and white flight. So I want to talk for a moment about white flight because, I'm going to skip that slide, because it plays out over and over again. It's not just a past and fixed creation. It's a pattern that we find reproducing itself. So this is going to come up in Sam's presentation, so I want to just very quickly show you that this whole logic, the perception, the bias, the history, the structure, the investments in whiteness have created a context in which 20% functions as a tipping point that initiates the process of white flight. If you're living in a neighborhood that's less than 20% Black, whites will move into that neighborhood, fewer than 20%. So that's a good thing. But any more than 20%, and the first thing that happens is whites stop moving in. So it could be 22 to 25%. They did a tremendous study. This comes from a book called American Apartheid by Massey and Benton, two very distinguished sociologists who won many awards. If it's more than 30%, whites sell their homes and move out. As you can see, if you think about this, this process creates segregation in and of itself. So it doesn't take long that when whites stop moving in, other people have to, somebody moves in. It ends up being non-white. The neighborhood eventually becomes all people of color. So this process can happen individually. People make their individual choice, but what happens? They actually produce it. And that means there's a deep investment in not being caught in this bigger than 30% of neighborhood because we know what the economic consequences that the market produces will be. So as you can see here, just in this brief schematic sense, that this is a normalized, legitimized project that happens historically and interpersonally and institutionally that routinely advantages whites by providing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes. Now, what Sam is going to do today is share a specific case that we worked on together to explain how this plays out on the ground more specifically. And because we're running out of time, I won't tell you this fantastic pedigree, but I'll tell you in the Q&A. Please join me in welcoming Sam Rosen.
I'm going to stop with Sam and sort of see if we can go back and sort of review some of the statements that were made by Dr. Rose, trying to bring together the autonomous number of institutions all wrapped under structural, as opposed to institutional. Now, let me just pause right there for 1 minute and just give you some information as it relates to that. Years ago, when I was working on my doctorate degree, the term institutional was the word that was used as we looked at different ways in which Black people were held to a almost with a foot around their throats, keeping them down. And in each of these institutions, there were all kinds of roadblocks that did not allow the Black person to go any further if they had an opportunity to just be at the foot of a possibility of job or education or whatever the case might be. Any of those institutions, except for criminal institutions, they definitely had a deep ride in that. But the term, without me getting so deeply involved with what I'm saying, that we experienced at that time back in the 1980s, in the 1970s, was a term that was more institutionally oriented. Dr. Rose and her Samuel Rosen developed a term called structural. Now, structural could be just about anything that has a size or a space to it. That's the physics will provide you with an abnormal amount of understanding of how that actually is structured. So it could be just about anything. So the term was changed from institutional to structural. And I'm not going to get involved with wondering why that term was changed, because institutional gave a much stronger ramification for how a person cannot get into a different situation. Structural is more in terms of them trying to be held to a back seat as opposed to a middle or front seat in the theater. So I just wanted to say those particular things and to give some clarification. And I'm not going to go back to listening to what she was talking about, but I'm going to go on to something that you might find extremely interesting. It was called A Panel Eruption Over Conversation of Race-Trump. So you might find this extremely interesting with the remaining amount of time that we have for the show. And so let's listen to this panel structure talk about race and how we today are dealing with it. And this is done basically... So I'm going to pause right there because I don't want you to get caught up in that. But I don't know why I have this difficulty with this crazy mouse. I just bought a new mouse and it has me all over the place.
Tim is an anti-racism writer and activist and the author of Dear White America.
Okay, let me pause for 1 minute. What you're getting ready to hear is an eruption over a conversation dealing with race Now, what you heard a few minutes ago was an intellectualizing structure of race and the various kinds of levels of race that we experience today, if you happen to be a person of color. Now, here, that is more of a intellectual exercise and with knowledge about why and how things are. Here we have some people on both sides of the fence arguing about the whole saying that we just heard. And you're going to see and understand this. Now, the person who's actually dealing with this is one of the announcers for CNN. And then we're going to move, and you're going to hear. I'm taking up a lot of time, so let me let you just listen.
Senior political commentators, Tara Setmeyer and Steve Cortez, are here as well. Good evening. So, Tim, CNN is aware of at least three separate incidents this attorney has been involved in. And one of the things that's ironic is that on his website, he offers services in multiple languages, including Spanish. When you saw this story, when I saw this story, I wanted to talk to you and I wanted to get your thoughts. What do you think?
Well, look, if the problem were just this one guy, then it wouldn't be worth having this conversation. But the reality is we've got video after video and incident after incident. Just in the last couple of weeks, how many white folks are calling police on black people for absolutely no reason? We've got videos of people melting down on YouTube, yelling at baristas at Starbucks about bad service and being discriminated against because they're white men and they can't catch a break. We've got story after story of young children, we're talking middle school age kids, being taunted with chants of build the wall, build the wall. And let me tell you this story. This is heartbreaking. A friend of mine who I've known for 35 years, his family lives in New York. His kid, middle school kid, was on a trip in Washington at the Smithsonian about a week ago. Very diverse group of middle school kids. They come across another group of kids, white kids, bunch of them with, you know, Make America Great Again t-shirts and hats. And one of the white kids in that t-shirt looks at his shirt, points at it, says, "This is made of cotton. Thank you for picking it." Says that to one of the black kids. None of the teachers, none of the chaperones do anything to this kid, and it nearly touches off a fracas. They had to get the kids from the diverse school out of there before anything went wrong. This is the kind of stuff that is happening. For every incident on tape, there are dozens of incidents that are not being caught on tape, and this is filtering down to young children. There's clearly something wrong culturally in this country that we're not addressing.
Tara, to you now. I mean, and listen, Tara, you've lived in the New York City metropolitan area. We've hung out here together. We know what New York City is like, very diverse. So you see a young, attractive, successful businessman screaming at people in Manhattan because they're speaking Spanish. What did you think?
Yeah, you know, this guy obviously is an equal opportunity xenophobe. You know, he's looking at this spectacle like this. It's disturbing, of course. You know, what are you doing in New York City? And I grew up in New Jersey. I mean, it's a melting pot in the Northeast like that. So to see these kinds of outbursts is like, what is happening? But I will tell you that, you know, after watching more and more videos of this guy, he's obviously got a problem. There's something wrong with him. He's clearly a racist. He's an equal opportunity xenophobe, like I said. One time it was about Latinos. Another time it was someone that was speaking in a Slavic language. Another time it was just an effing foreigner he called someone. So, you know, this guy is the epitome of something that's been unearthed, I think, since in the era of Trump. And as someone who is biracial, who has lived in New York and New Jersey, who has lived in Washington, D.C., and who's been all over the country, all over the world, actually, I have never seen the kinds of ugliness that I've seen from people who you wouldn't expect, right, since Trump came into office. And in the Republican Party, I have to say, the party that I have been a part of and as a conservative for most of my adult life, to sit back and make excuses for it or to stay silent and just kind of act as though this is not happening is very disconcerting for me, and they should be ashamed of themselves for not acknowledging that Donald Trump had created an environment to divide people and make it okay because of the way he behaves and the things that he has said.
I need to get to Steven. Steve, what do you say?
Look, this guy's an ass. I don't know how else to say it, right? He's an ass. He's making fun of people for speaking Spanish. It's offensive to everyone. It's certainly offensive to me as a Latino. to try to fix the behavior of one man, to ascribe the behavior of one jerk to Donald Trump, to me, is an absurd leap of logic. This guy's a jerk. I don't see the political bent here. I just don't.
Okay, hang on, Sarah. Hold on, Sarah, hold on. Please. Every time we have a video and we put it on, right, someone who supports Trump says, this is one person.
Right.
And to ascribe that to one person is just outrageous. And we put on another one, and you say the same thing. And we put on another one, and you say the exact same thing. And another one, and another one, and another one. So how long does that excuse hold water that it's just one person? Every single person here just said it's more than one person. It's more than one person.
I will answer that, all right, as a minority, all right, as a son of an immigrant who had a dad who, by the way, spoke with a heavy accent, embarrassed me as a kid. I'm ashamed of it embarrassed me, but that's just
the way. We've got three minorities on this panel. Go on. We get it. Go on.
Okay.
Make your point, please.
All right. But but it's important, Don, okay? That's what I'm saying. I've lived this. I get it. Yes, it is important.
You can be a minority and still be a bigot.
No. Hold on.
You can be a minority and still not be aware of bigotry.
I'm still talking, Don.
You can be a minority and still make excuses for bigots and racists and homophobes
and xenophobes.
I'm saying
I get the idea of being other is what I'm saying. I get the idea of being out of the norm, right, of speaking with an accent or speaking a different language. I get it totally. I get it in a visceral sense. I also believe this about America, thank goodness. Country, which
can
was once fundamentally
can we stick to the point?
Right.
Steve, stick to the point.
Yeah, I'm on
about
point.
This
do you let me? Do you mind?
I've got a minute. Can you just stick to the point?
You're not even letting me get to my point. This
it's
country
taking you too long.
Once,
come on, move it along.
Fundamentally racist. I'll be quick. This country was once fundamentally racist that believed that black people could be owned, elected twice a black man. Named Barack Hussein Obama.
Donald Trump, we elected him. He had a lot of time.
And he took up a lot of air.
Yeah.
If Barack Obama winning twice means that racism is fundamentally eradicated, then I guess Steve would argue that there's no real sexism in Pakistan because a woman, Benazir Bhutto, was elected there twice. That's an ignorant seventh grade level argument that has just been made on national television. Surely we can do better than that.
But we also can just use the examples of Donald Trump himself, the things that he has said from, you know, the Judge Curiel stuff, that he couldn't be a good judge because he was a Mexican. You know, the comments that he has made, the bigoted comments over and over again, have given people like this jerk off license to be able to think it's okay to behave this way. Look at how many people running for Congress have said things that are inappropriate as Republicans. Look what Blankenship did in West Virginia. Thank God he lost. You know, talking about Chinamen in Mitch McConnell's family. And you've got this guy down in Georgia running around in a deportation bus, for goodness sake.
Right.
This kind of stuff, my point is that these people are feeling emboldened to do it because the President of the United States says there's people on both sides who start with
Okay, let him respond.
Here's the thing, okay? This Schlossberg, again, I don't know how many ways I can say it. He's apparently a racist. He's an ass. He should be paid no attention to. But here's the thing, too. What's going on now is that, well, so what? What does that
so
mean?
The law of large people feel it's okay to behave this way at
Trump
rally. Why is it okay?
Racism has become. It has become not the scarlet A, but the scarlet R. It's become the scarlet letter of the left. When they don't want to talk policy, when you all don't want to talk about what we are doing in the Trump movement for minorities, by the way, for their prosperity and security, what you do is you call us racist, and it's a way of maligning us, it's a way of marginalizing us, and taking us out of the debate.
Who's talking about
you?
Hold on, Tim. Steve, why are you personalizing this? No one calls you a racist.
No one.
Yeah.
You're saying someone from the left
told this guy to go into a restaurant and call out people for not
speaking. Right.
No.
or the guy, the white guy at the Trump rally,
that's how I said it all,
the black guy, or Trump.
What I'm saying is,
because
I am a supporter of Trump, I have been affixed to this jerk, even though I have nothing to do with him.
But that's the thing. When children are walking around,
I came out.
When children are walking around,
he's wearing a Make America Great Hat again. When children are walking around in Trump gear, talking to black children about picking cotton.
The law of,
let me finish. I didn't interrupt you, really, except for the $500 comment. Let me finish. If anyone had been walking around in Obama shirts and hats in 2008, attacking white people verbally, or making $500 contributions to Barack Obama's campaign, you know full well that you would have made an issue of it. You would have asked Barack Obama to condemn those people. And
no,
you
I wouldn't.
Certainly
and
not.
No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't.
Look, the law of large numbers, okay, when you have tens of millions of people, you're going to have crazies on both sides. This guy's a crazy. There are crazies on the left. That is the law of large numbers.
So you don't think that it comes from the top when President Trump makes the comments that he makes, that doesn't embolden these crazies to come out? I mean, I can remember when Bill Buckley, who was a conservative hero of mine, cast out the John Birch Society because of how inappropriate and the fanatical positions that they were taking. He took a stand because it was the right thing to do. Why can't you just take a stand and condemn the kinds of things that Donald Trump has said that is emboldening these kinds of people and emboldening these nutcases and fanatics and racists and bigots and put an eye next to their name?
If we're going to follow this logic, did the shooter of Congressman Scalise, all right, is that Bernie Sanders' fault? Because he happened to be an ardent supporter of Bernie Sanders? I think that's ludicrous logic. But by your logic,
Bernie Sanders, hold on,
every bit as complicit.
Okay, here's the difference. Bernie Sanders and his supporters condemned it.
Right.
They said,
immediately. I condemn it right here on national television.
No, you're making
it seem as if it's a
loom.
Why won't you condemn the thing Trump has said?
I'm saying this guy's a loom. I am totally condemning him. He does not represent the president, and he doesn't represent our movement.
When this president said the last president wasn't even born in this country, and he believed that publicly for 4 years, you didn't condemn that. That was blatant dog whistling.
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, actually, you don't know me because I did. Yes, I did.
Do you think
I condemned it many times on air, and I said that was a foolish. That was a foolish.
No, it wasn't foolish.
It was
racist.
And I wish he had racist. All right, and so it was foolish. And so,
no, but you just
race.
Said I didn't condemn it, and
Steve,
I did. And
Steve,
I'm on the record.
Okay,
you condemned it. You condemned it, and you condemned the guy for doing it. You saying this doesn't represent the Trump movement. Okay, fine. You believe that. Do you think that when President Trump or Donald Trump said that the former president wasn't born in this country and kept it going and was the biggest promoter of that, do you think that was racist?
I don't think it was racist, but I think it was a big mistake. And again, I said that again. Not just today. I said it at the time.
Not able to do a job as a judge because he's a Mexican.
I said that again and again. But the idea that
has this president ever done anything that you think is racist?
Or said anything?
Or said anything?
Gosh, no. Absolutely not. He's not a racist.
Not
this man, and I know him. This man wants. No, and again, here you go with the scarlet letter. Here you go.
Stand by. Stand by. Play it.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest?
I would like to have him show his birth certificate. If he can't, and if he wasn't born in this country, which is a real possibility. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying it's a real possibility.
His wife... if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me.
You had some very bad people in that group.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Are you
ready? I am the least racist person that you have ever met.
You want to change your mind, Steve, or do you still stick with it, what you said?
No, I'm not changing my mind. And by the way, as I just said, The birth certificate controversy, I thought, was absurd. I don't know why he went down that road.
It's not
a certain mistake.
The word is racist.
He also – no, it's not racist. Stop it.
Well, maybe
he's
not.
No, that's not true.
Trump was
by the way,
being racist.
He
he
during the campaign reversed himself and said the president was clearly born in the United States. He corrected himself, okay?
But he continued
on the record.
There were people investigating,
finding
himself.
Amazing, incredible things, which was a blatant lie. He hadn't hired anybody to find anything. Nobody was finding anything. There was nothing to find. He was pushing buttons of racial resentment, trying to get white folks to believe that the president of the United States was not an American citizen. And all throughout 2009 and 2010, at those Tea Party rallies, you had folks out there with posters, with pictures of the president with a bone through his nose, dressed like an African witch doctor, saying, go back to Kenya. That is racism. And if you can't call it that, then it is because you do not understand the meaning of the word in spite of your ethnicity and background, which apparently you think gives you some type of gravitas to have this conversation. But the word is the word.
No,
it means what it means. And this president is guilty of it time and time again.
I also think, once again, and
I don't know.
Donald Trump
there are crazies on both sides. There are crazies on your side. There are crazies on the right. That doesn't mean that the leader, doesn't mean Bernie Sanders is responsible for the shooter.
How often
do you see
Donald Trump
on your side?
It doesn't mean Donald Trump is responsible for this guy.
How often do you see
the on both sides, as you say? How often do you see the other side doing this?
Quite a bit. I mean, like I just said, the violence of the ballpark against Republicans.
Okay, that's one
point.
Incident
I
which is off.
Roll the tape. Roll the
people,
tape.
People who are ugly.
Where are yours? People who are ugly or violent on either side should be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They should be. They should be relegated
why
to the sidelines. They don't matter.
Why would you dismiss an example of something that's in your face time and time and time again? And by the way, I take umbrage to you saying that this guy or you, whoever made the point that this guy is crazy, there's clearly something wrong with him. I don't know that. I encounter people like him all the time. These are everyday racists. These are everyday bigots. These are people that you encounter all the time in life, and every time it happens, you just can't say, oh, my gosh, this person is crazy and conflating him with people who have something wrong with him. They have something wrong with him. What's wrong with them is that they're racist. And that it happens more than you think. And this is an example to people like you and to others who don't believe it happens.
Or the
if
same thing
in
bullying.
Society, how could we have elected Barack Obama? I mean, I really mean
it's
that.
Two separate things. You can still have people that elected Barack Obama, and there's also still a percentage of this country that are still bigoted and racist and think it's okay to behave like this because the president of the United States does. He sets
this
an example.
This idea that voting for Barack Obama, I already explained, you know, the Benazir Bhutto example, which I guess your
ears. I don't care
about
your past.
I'm not really sure.
That has nothing to do with the United States.
Irrelevant.
Okay,
but do you not know how metaphor and analogies work? Analogies work because
I hear one
thing.
Very well.
No, you don't. Because if you did, you would understand.
But let's talk
about
having one person from
a marginalized group become the leader of a country says nothing about how other people from that group are experiencing that country. That is an analogy. It is direct. You do not understand it. Saying that voting for Barack Obama means that you can't be racist is like a guy who's heterosexual saying that because he dates or sleeps with or is married to a woman, he can't be a sexist. There's another analogy that completely destroys whatever point you are trying to make.
It's just deflecting because he won't acknowledge that Donald Trump makes bigoted statements. He's done it over and over. His own history Donald Trump was sued for racial discrimination in the 90s by black dealers in Atlantic City. He's made comments. It's well known that he's made comments that were off the cuff and inappropriate about blacks. And he even disputes an account in a book that was written about him where he said he would never have a black count his money. I mean, it's on and on. The Central Park Five, the way he spoke to these things, the way his own behavior. He didn't condemn the people, white people that knocked
out black people at his
rallies. I mean, the things that he has said and done that you will not acknowledge. And this breeds this kind of culture now that we see with people that feel emboldened to behave like this other guy.
Okay, so before you answer, Steve, let me ask, I'm glad you said MAGA hats. So then why are people who are wearing MAGA hats and MAGA shirts and screaming MAGA and making why does it seem like it's always them if it's not an issue that has to do with Donald Trump?
It's certainly not always them. There's a lot of violence from Antifa. There's a lot of violence from many sides here, and there shouldn't be, by the way.
That's true.
Political
too.
Violence, racism, bigotry is awful from any side. I'll say this, too, by the way. If Donald Trump is a racist, which he clearly isn't, I know him, he's not. But if he is, he's remarkably bad at it because all he has done is make life better since he was elected for minorities, for African Americans,
really?
And for Hispanics.
Okay.
Economically,
right.
Their prosperity, their security are only increasing under the policies of Donald Trump. So
which means that
we're remarkably bad racist.
The fact that people of color don't agree with
that
by and large
means
that
they are delusional. I guess the fact that black folks by and large don't see it that
no.
way, and brown folk by and large don't see it that way, and they don't vote that way, means that you and Donald Trump know black and brown folks' truth better than they actually know their own truth, which is the fascinating example of prejudice.
No, it means that we need to. It means that we need to win them over, and we are starting.
But people
to
know their own
minds.
Actually,
know their own minds. Countries,
that they belong
countries.
In the Republican
why can't
Party.
They have more, like, more ways of winning people
for
over?
Donald Trump. That's what it means.
So there are. So you didn't live. You didn't live through the Obama administration when Obama brought the black and really brought the black unemployment rate down, and really pulled the economy into. A better place. So
right.
That has nothing to do with the black president. That has nothing to do with that. That's all from Donald.
The chasm.
We can have a different conversation.
Let's talk facts,
Don.
Let's talk facts.
The
chasm between white household wealth and minority household wealth widened under the Obama years. And that has actually declined. Because the wealth gap has not declined.
Because
most blacks and Hispanics.
Yeah.
Are among
but
the
policy versus attitude of different.
The wealth growth of the Obama years was wonderful for people who owned a lot of assets, which generally, unfortunately, does not include blacks and Hispanics. I want it to, and I think that will happen. I want blacks and Hispanics to be wealthy and own assets. But for the most part, were wage earners, and wage earners had a terrible slog under the slow growth of the Obama
years. So, Steve, you have no concern about the, what seems like a spike in these racist incidents. Since this president came to fore,
and anti-Semitism.
No, well, those are two different anti-Semitism. Are you getting?
Yeah.
Donald Trump has been a better friend to Israel than any president has been. Probably.
Well, he's all right, crazy.
Why is it?
Why is it?
Hold on.
Why is it?
Why is it?
As the only
not
friend,
panel.
Hold on.
Not a friend.
Hold on.
As the only Jew on the panel, let me just say the idea that anti-Semitism can be reduced to your view on Israel is offensive to me as a Jewish person. That's not what it means to stand up against anti-Semitism. What it means to stand up against it is when Nazis march in an American city and a college town, you do not coddle them and say that there were fine people on that side. It used to be we understood there was a difference between Nazis and people who fought Nazis. My grandfathers fought Nazis, and we praised them and called them the greatest generation. Now we have a president who makes excuses for them, and he is your friend. Deal with him. Come get your people, please.
All right. I got to go. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you totally understood that, but I did. And we only have a few minutes left to go in the show. If those of you who are just joining in, you just had a fantastic evening with two different groups. One, the intellectual structure college professor and friend who did research on what they call structural racism, which was previously called institutional racism. It causes a lot of confusion trying to figure out the different terminologies. That's the first one. The second one was a Don Lemon show on CNN, and he had on his panel three people, all of which were minorities, two Hispanic and one young lady who was African American, and Don Lemon. And it just seems that one person who was Hispanic had a very difficult time of being able to see what Donald Trump has done and what seems to want to continue to do with people of color. In any event, you have been listening to Getting It Done, and I have been your host, at least for certain intervals, Dr. Dean. And so what we're going to do is bring the show to a close and
tell you that it was great having you. And hopefully you listen to next week's show, which will be something that will be very, very similar to the show that we had just now. Once again, Friday, we do jazz. And so tune in at that particular time. Have a good evening, ladies and gentlemen, until Friday. Thank you. Bye-bye.